You're listening to the Insightful Connections podcast. Our guest today is Andrei Zhukov-Gregorich. Andrei is a co-founder at Unsurvey. Founded in 2024, Unsurvey is a platform for running qual interviews using AI that helps researchers speak to an order of magnitude more people than ever before possible. Unlike others in the AI qual at scale space, Unsurvey can run rich, human-like voice-to-voice conversations thanks to Unsurvey's Conversational Flow Builder, allowing clients to steer conversations in complex ways to capture more nuanced insights. Prior to founding Unsurvey, Andrei worked at BlackRock as a researcher, and prior to that, he did his PhD in natural language processing at University of London. Andrei, thanks so much for being on the podcast today.
Thanks, Sebastian. A pleasure.
Hey, guys. Seb here. I wanted to take a quick break to tell you about something I'm genuinely excited about. You know how we're always talking about getting better at understanding people and deep diving into what makes them tick? Well, there's this conference coming up that basically is heaven for anyone who loves that kind of work. It's the QRCA Qualitative Research Consultants Association annual conference. It's happening in Philly this February. And let me tell you, this isn't your typical stuffy corporate gathering. I've been before, and it's this amazing mix of learning and actually having fun with people who get what we do. They're doing something really cool this time around. They're opening it up to everyone in qual research, whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out. And there's something special for our listeners. I arranged for you all to get $50 off your registration with the code INSIGHTSVIP. That's INSIGHTSVIP, all one word. But wait, here's what makes this even better. Every time someone uses this code, QRCA is going to donate $25 to the Market Research Education Foundation. These folks do amazing work helping children around the world through education initiatives. So you're not just investing in your own professional development, you're helping create opportunities for kids who really need it. How cool is that? Head over to the QRCA's website to learn more and register. And don't forget that code, INSIGHTSVIP. Thanks.
So I like to ask this question to everybody who comes on the episode, and I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about your professional journey personally and how it ended up taking you to market research as a space. I think from what I know of you, some of that happened at BlackRock as well. So I'm curious to know more about that journey, how it brought you here and how it accounts for where you are and where you're going.
Oh gosh, that's a great question. I have always optimized for having an eclectic career. I think life is too short to climb long ladders in large corporations, even though I guess I did work for one at one point in time. To give you like a whirlwind tour of my career, I studied computer science, moved straight into a PhD, initially dabbled with probability theory, but those were the years where there was a lot going on in natural language processing, which today I guess we often just call AI. Back then we were very uncomfortable with calling natural language processing AI because it was just so far from its capabilities today. So I did a PhD in the field and worked specifically on various forms of what's called entity recognition and entity linking. You can think of that as basically highlighting words in long pieces of text. So nothing too groundbreaking. And I'm happy to say that my entire PhD is now worthless since the whole world transitioned into modern day AI. But I did get to see, you know, some of those beginnings of applying neural networks to problems within the natural language processing and AI space. And over the subsequent years, that led me into working for a small startup in London that was trying to automate customer service. This was back in 2015 to 2020, back when it was essentially impossible. Thankfully, they've hit an inflection point since. So props to them and shout out to Digital Genius. And then I moved to BlackRock, where amongst other things, I was also working on natural language processing. And one of the projects that I was tasked with was reading all of the world's news every single day using algorithms and trying to derive information from that. And so that information would end up being used for making investment decisions or et cetera. But really, my focus was on how do you process all the world's news quickly and efficiently as it hits or as it hit our servers. And back then, this was still using very rudimentary techniques. And I remember working at BlackRock, and we were sort of the oddballs in the team. And it was very, very clear that the technology that we were applying, although cool at the time, had very, very severe and distinct limits. Anyway, fast forward, the pandemic hits. My original co-founder and I got very, very bored and decided to jump ship. After 2 weeks worth work on a MVP demo, we applied to Y Combinator, got told that the idea was terrible, but got asked to join nonetheless, joined, worked on initially a startup to do with pricing, And what we notice with pricing, so market research is actually a core component of pricing research. Now, we were initially trying to solve it algorithmically by showing different prices to different people, but actually the way the pricing optimization, let's call it industry, works is fundamentally by doing market research across sample that you ask questions about what their propensity to pay is using all sorts of different methodologies. And that's kind of when the switch clicked. We thought, well, wait a minute, we could just do that at scale using the AI, which by then was much improved. So that's sort of the short arc of where my career has gone thus far.
That's super interesting. Why specifically did Y Combinator tell you that your idea was terrible? And why did they, you know, in spite of that, invite you in?
I'm almost ashamed to say, but we applied with an idea called Middle Out, which was an homage to Silicon Valley, the TV show, which if anyone's watched in the TV show, the team essentially creates a startup that is capable of running a compression algorithm sort of much faster than anyone else using a middle out methodology, so sort of a technical term. Anyway, we called it Middle Out. Anyone in startup land would know about it and get a good chuckle out of it, thinking that that would increase our chances. But the idea was abysmal. The idea had something to do with us not liking middle management. And so we had a pie in the sky idea of, well, you could just swap out middle management with smart AIs that keep both leadership and folks on the ground up to date with what's going on. By the way, this was during COVID when any kind of future of work idea was obviously in vogue. And of course, Y Combinator, having seen many thousands of startups, immediately identified our idea as a COVID idea, told us that it was terrible, but they still liked us as a team. And so as a result of that, we thankfully had a chance to go in.
I'm curious to know more about, do you know what drew them to you as a team?
I think in general, one of the things that YC is, and VCs in general, I wouldn't say this is necessarily a Y Combinator thing, but I think they're drawn to hackers that can build, that sort of have a proven track record of actually building something, whether it's with their hands or, you know, with their hands touching a keyboard, perhaps preferably. And then the other thing is just a certain sort of curiosity, a certain, you know, speeds to action, a certain sense of you being able to iterate quickly. And I think that, you know, with the 2-week idea that we had iterated on, we had managed to secure a few early clients and there was some sort of notional sign of traction. And I think that in that sense, we sort of ticked the boxes of what at least they think makes for a good founder. I think that it's essentially making sure that all those boxes are ticked. That's basically it.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about AI. Obviously, that is the area that you guys are focused on. You all are an AI startup. I think I touched a little bit on what Unsurvey does in the blurb at the start, but I think one of the things that was interesting was this idea that you and I spoke a little bit about before we started just now of AI's role in market research sort of collapsing the boundaries between qual and quant. And I'm wondering if you can expand a little bit on what that means to you.
Historically, there was a firewall between qual and quant for, I guess, very obvious reasons, right? So you could scale quant, you could send a survey to thousands of respondents, whereas qual, you never really could. I guess there were ways of getting folks to, let's say, respond via chatbot and so on that have been explored over the years, but really no one's cracked qual at scale. And so it's really as simple as that. Quant, you can scale, qual, you couldn't. And as a result of that, you would use each of those methodologies for different things. And oftentimes what we would see is that folks would do a quant survey followed with a qual survey for sort of additional qual information. And those would get turned into very traditional qual style reports, right? So collections of verbatim quotes and something that just sort of paints a picture as to the sample that was interviewed. But what's changing now is that you can do qual at scale. And what I mean by that is you will be able to replace the human interviewer with an AI. And assuming we're entering into a world where you can do qual at scale, this boundary between quant and qual in terms of scale obviously falls apart because you can do qual at scale now. But there's something else that happens that's quite interesting, which is thanks to today's modern natural language processing algorithms, you can actually very quickly and efficiently pull out quantitative insights from the unstructured qual data that you capture. And so instead of asking questions that involve clicking radio buttons and strongly agreeing or disagreeing, for example, you can pull some of that sentiment out of a more natural reply that a respondent gave at one of these qualit scale interviews. And so really that's the barrier that is breaking down.
What value do you think there is to unlock by collecting quantitative insights in an open-ended format or maybe scaling up qualitative methods?
I think there's a few things, but I think two that are of particular note. So the first one, of course, is just a cost-based one. You know, I'll give you an example. We're starting to work with a client that, well, is looking to survey 1,200 people, and they've also have been looking for an agency to run a representative qual study across that population of 1,200 people. The problem, of course, is that that representative sample in their mind is something in the tune of 30 people, and because they just cannot afford more in terms of the quotes that they have been getting from agencies. Now, a tool such as ours can come in and interview all 1,200 of them, at least from a cost perspective in terms of, you know, us running this service at almost marginal cost. Of course, we would sort of upcharge for something, but the actual cost of running 1,200 interviews is almost like the cost of running software as opposed to the cost of paying a human for an hour of their time. So one of the big advantages, of course, is just simply cost. You can now do these things at scale much cheaper. The other thing which I think is fascinating is also just the respondent experience of taking some of these things. And I think this is yet to be proven. I think as a field in its totality, AI is still learning what best practices in its UX are. And so what I mean by that is it's sort of a week does not go by when we as an AI community are wowed by what all the various labs and companies are putting out there in terms of just user experience of new things that are hitting the market. And to relate this back to quant versus qual, I think that from a UX experience, market research has been relatively static for a while now. A survey still looks like a survey. But I don't think that a survey will still look like a survey a couple of years from now. And so I think that, you know, it's much more natural for humans to perhaps chat to one another than it is for us to answer a 10-page survey, even when incentivized. And so I do hope that, at least in part, AI will help unlock some of these new user experiences that haven't been doable before.
I wanted to dive a little more into that idea of earlier on, you were talking about how AI might change the UX of research. And that's really threefold. And you very neatly categorized the UX of research across sort of three areas, one being the respondent experience as a user in research, navigating the tools that we use to research them. The other being the builder experience, right? The experience of being somebody who is drafting, scripting, fielding the tools that we use to collect data, however we do it. And the final being the analysis experience. I think that's a really neat categorization, and I'm a big fan of nice categorizations. So I'm curious, like across those domains, and this could be aside from just sort of the experience of taking a survey, but across those domains, how do you see AI broadly changing the way that we interact with research as users in all of our different orientations?
Oh, absolutely. So let's go over all of those in turn. You know, on the respondent experience, I already alluded to how the UX of the respondent experience might fundamentally change over the coming years. What does that mean specifically and more practically? And I'll give you a view from our side, which is voice AI interviews to do qual at scale. I think that there are potentially many other ramifications of AI, but very specifically, this is what I mean from our perspective. So when two people speak to one another, there is a whole lot of user experience of UX that sort of goes on in a conversation like that. And I'm sure that there is a very good reason why certain qual researchers are very much worth their money. They've been doing this for years, for decades. They sort of know the subtleties of human psychology and how to elicit true information, essentially, from whoever it is they're interviewing. And I don't think that AI will necessarily reach their level for a while. But what does it mean to break down that respondent UX experience that happens when two people speak? A couple of examples. One is making sure that the two entities, the AI and the human, do not interrupt each other, which is actually easier said than done. You know, I think most folks are pretty proficient at not interrupting each other when they speak, but AIs sometimes really struggle with that. I think it's a problem that's only really been solved in the past couple of months, you know, from an AI perspective.
My kids are still figuring it out.
Right. And I think what's truly amazing about our ability to pause when we speak is that it's so dependent on the type of character, in a sense, we are. Some folks like to pause and think before they deliver a point. Others just immediately jump in. Others use many filler words. Some don't, etc. So making sure that an AI is attuned to that and can correctly solve for that is one such example of what a good respondent experience looks like. And here's another one. I think that in general, oftentimes, the motion of speaking to someone is a form of us wanting to get to what it is we want to say by using our own words. So we typically have something that we want to convey in our mind, and perhaps on attempt number one, we're not particularly great at doing it. And so a good qual researcher will sometimes ask folks for clarifications or follow-up questions or probing questions that they'll ask to really make sure that the respondent conveys what it is they really want it to convey. So those are the examples on the respondent side. And I think we could spend an entire day talking about them. But those are the kinds of things that folks, I think, are very interested from the respondent side. Now, on the builder side, I think that AI, even outside of the realms of startups looking to focus on market research specifically, I think AI has already somewhat changed the game, especially in certain tasks. So I'll give you an example. I was on a call this week with a market researcher where we were brainstorming questions to ask. And on the call, they went to ChatGPT and dumped a few comments into ChatGPT 4.0, I believe, and hit generate. And out of that, they got a bunch of questions. This is more of a general UX view of AI. One of the things that AI has allowed us to do is to somewhat taper down the cold start problem of starting a task. AI is really good at getting us from 0 to 0.1, and then we can take it from 0.1 to 1. And so I think that that has ramifications in market research too, whether it's more quickly iterating, whether in agency or with client on a set of questions to ask. But I think another large component of the builder experience is also the liaison experience, the experience of actually speaking to an internal stakeholder, an insights lead in an organization who's having to speak to multiple internal stakeholders to get back to an agency in terms of what it is that they want to do. And then perhaps they want to do too much. And so the agency pushes back, et cetera. So this is like a very sort of typical motion within the first 2 weeks of a project. And I think that AI has a role there too for being almost an arbiter, connector, a message passer between all those two entities as they agree on what it is they want the projects to deliver. So those are a few examples of where I think AI impacts the builder experience. Finally, on the analysis side, again, I will give you an example from our lens, but I think there are some other interesting things going on in the industry that we're not tackling quite yet. So on the analysis side, I think just coming from a natural language processing background, going from unstructured text data to quantitative insights has grown in leaps and bounds over the past 15 years or so. To give you an example, now we can legitimately say that AIs are very good at automatic coding or data capture. So you can go from unstructured pieces of text to a table, a sort of codified table where every column has a, I guess in computer science, we would call it a type or it belongs to a certain set of categories. And so that kind of data capture now is almost trivially easy, whereas historically, to assign, let's say, a sentiment score to a row would have involved a team of data scientists or perhaps PhDs coming up with a sentiment model specific to the task at hand. So those are the kinds of things that modern day AI can now do very easily. And so I think it's not something that I think, you know, we're unique in saying, but I do think that that's really sort of changed the way natural language processing analysis works. The other thing to mention on perhaps the analysis side, or I guess it covers all three of those categories that I mentioned, is there is interesting work going on in synthetic sample, but it's not necessarily a major focus area for us just yet. We do have some theories about it, but I do think that this thread of saying, well, large language models are sort of trained on the aggregate of human knowledge, including lots and lots of consumer interactions on places such as Reddit. Therefore, does that mean that out of an LLM, we can pull out consumer preference as well? Perhaps. Perhaps yes, perhaps no. I do think there are smart ways of doing it. And we are actually working with academic researchers on some of these topics. I do think that perhaps synthetic data is much stronger in things that are more talked about. So it perhaps does better in, let's say, political topics or sort of core ethical topics that most of us care about and have an opinion about. Perhaps it doesn't hold as much power when arguing about B2B SaaS features, but it is undoubtedly a completely new area for market research as an industry to explore in the years ahead.
Andre, I wanted to dive into one last sort of topic area with you, which is, you know, kind of, we've talked a lot about how sort of aspects of the research process at a more tactical level might change. But I'm thinking more generally, you know, 5 to 10 years into the future at a high level, how do you envision the way that we work changing in response to AI? As somebody who's, you know, pretty close to AI, you know, I think more so than most in space, what are sort of the ways in working that you expect are going to change, not just with the current state of AI, but with where it's going into the future?
Well, first of all, I'm definitely one of those folks that advocates for sort of the democratization of how we think about AI, in the sense that I don't necessarily think AI researchers are the best people to give us insight on that topic. I really do think that one of the beautiful things about modern day AI is that ChatGPT and other tools are seeing so much mass consumer usage that there are ways of using AI that are being explored by young kids in their bedrooms, sort of unknown to any of us, right? That I think are extremely impactful and very far away from what AI researchers or AI founders even, you know, of our generation are necessarily working on. But I would say a couple of things. One is that I think it's very clear that just over the course of the next 12 to 24 months, we're going to see some very obvious improvements in what AI can do. And I think from that, we can then extrapolate kind of where the world goes. So here's what's going to happen over the next 12 to 24 months, and then also to relate it to perhaps what could happen in the next 10 years or so. So from a voice AI perspective, all of those small problems that I mentioned before, knowing when to pause, being emotive, being able to laugh or to sing or to modulate voice or to change accent or dialect or to speak in different languages, basically to be more human, that is going to drastically improve over the next 12 months. The next thing that'll happen is that the cost of running AI is going to continue to fall. So imagine being able to use GPT-4 today, but at a much, much lower cost. What that means is more startups doing more things with these models and these tools. To give you a very concrete example, from a voice AI perspective, the cost of running a voice AI call on a per minute basis hovers between, I would say, 10 and 30 cents per minute, which is completely okay for doing qualitative, high margin market research at scale, not necessarily as impactful if you are doing a very simple customer support call. But those costs are going to fall over the following months. And so that's going to unlock areas of the market. And then, of course, two more important things that will happen. One is the ability of these AIs to reason across these long, what were previously separate chains of thought that were comprised of multiple calls previously. AIs today are being trained on the A to Z reasoning. So they're being trained on actually chains of reasoning that go way deeper than just a single prompt and a single answer. And so they stand a very good chance of becoming a lot smarter in the near future. And then finally, I think that, you know, just from a consumer acceptance standpoint, very tactically, we're going to have Apple Intelligence, we're going to have tools in people's pockets that are not necessarily just ChatGPT. I was recently on a flight between San Francisco and New York, where a kid next to me sat for the entire flight on in-flight Wi-Fi, texting with his AI girlfriend on character AI, right? So, you know, we're really entering a brave new world in terms of consumer acceptance of a lot of this stuff. But I guess the big question is, well, where does that lead us 10 years from now? And I think that one thing is very clear, and I almost have 100% certainty in that it'll happen, which is I think the premium quality human connection is going to go up. And then make of that what you will in terms of what its sort of ramifications for the market are. But I think that you can see this from, let's say, a B2B SaaS founder perspective. One of the things that perhaps you may have noticed already is just a number of cold outreach AI-generated emails that are hitting your inbox. And some of them are even personalized to you. So sometimes they even sort of pass the sniff test and you think it's a human that wrote it, when in effect, it was an AI. So just like how our generation could tell the difference between a song rip on LimeWire that had a virus and one that didn't by just looking at the title description of what it is we were trying to download in the 2000s, but our parents couldn't, I think that in the future, people will become very discerning of the difference between AI and non-AI. And I think as a result of that, I think the premium on non-AI human interactions will sort of grow hand in hand with just acceptance with legitimate AI interactions as well. So I think that's one thing that will definitely happen. In terms of the impact on our work lives, I think that a good window into the future is to just see where is AI really exponentially taking off already. And it has already exponentially taken off with developers, with programmers. And the way that I would characterize it, I think it was the CEO of NVIDIA, or perhaps Sam Altman, who said that the future of programming is English. And I think that that's such a succinct, beautiful way of putting it in terms of a very common workflow 5 years ago for a programmer was to, if they got stuck, they would go on Google and then they would type in the question they had and they would almost automatically click link number one, which 9 out of 10 times was Stack Overflow, a website that developers use to help each other. And then they would go to Stack Overflow and they wouldn't even read the question. They would scroll immediately down to answer number one, and they would copy paste the block of code that they found on answer number one. So it's sort of akin to going to a Reddit thread and reading the first comment because it was most upvoted. Nowadays, usage of Stack Overflow has collapsed. And instead of using Stack Overflow, developers are using ChatGPT and other tools to get work done. And instead of general answers, they actually have now specific generated answers, i.e. generated blocks of code that they can just copy paste into the product that they're building and it'll just work. What does this mean? It actually means something really interesting. I think if you plot developer proficiency on the x-axis, so you go from junior developers, folks who don't know much about programming, to average developers, to what the industry calls 10x developers, folks that can get a lot done, you know, very quickly, the sort of magical developers who are incredibly fast and good. If you plot the impact or the proficiency boost that AI gives these people, what you see happen is that the junior developers oftentimes don't benefit all that much from it because they are still learning the language of code, as it were, right? They're still sort of being stuck with certain basics. The average developers have seen a 10x boost in productivity, and the 10x developers are perhaps most cautious with the use of AI because it's still hallucinating and it still doesn't give as good of an answer as they sometimes give. So I think that this is a general pattern which will happen, which is that folks that are average, and there's nothing wrong with being average, we're all average in something, folks that are average at a particular task will oftentimes see a 10x boost in their productivity. The cold start problem will be solved for them. They'll be able to move way faster. I think as a society, we're going to grapple with the hollowing out of junior productivity. You see this in the software development world already. The need for juniors has somewhat collapsed. And I do think that true experts, the true 10xers, are going to continue to provide tremendous value with or without AI. And I think that, you know, again, just sort of, you know, bringing it down to a more personal note, I think it's going to be important for all of us to make sure that we sort of cross this average to expert chasm by not allowing ourselves to just perform at a 10x rate with the help of AI, but that we sort of continue to take time off and pick up a book and read it by ourselves under a light and not use AI necessarily to reach that 10x proficiency status. So I think that's sort of a few things that I see happening in the future.
Last question from me, Andre. What keeps you motivated?
Ooh, that's a great question. This is going to sound very bland, but I think, look, life is short. I think that every generation lives through a seismic change. I think we're living through one now. I wouldn't say that AI is the only seismic change we're living through at all. There are many others, as has been the case with every generation. And these seismic shifts and changes rock up static ways of doing things. And I think whenever you see, you know, to take a leaf out of BlackRock, whenever you see high volatility in the market, that's also when the opportunity for making most alpha, most money lies. Now, I don't mean that it's the money that drives me, but I think the kind of thirst for high volatility opportunities where we all stand a chance of learning much faster than ever before because things are shifting. That's what keeps me going and wakes me up.
Andre, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Sebastian.